Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to Ethics Talk. I invite you to join my learned colleagues and I as we return to our roots. On tonight's show, we discuss the lecture American Scholar by Ralph Waldo Emerson. Please check out the PDF of the speech if you'd like to follow along. That's posted at ethicstalk.cmish.edu under Show Resources. The speech was given by Ralph Waldo Emerson to the Phi Beta Kappa, I believe that's Honor Society, is it not?
Yeah, it's some sort of genius honor society.
Right, like the Mensa for college students or something like that. Okay, well, he gave the speech to Phi Beta Kappa at Harvard, and it's been called by Oliver Wendell Holmes the Intellectual Declaration of Independence, kind of America's breaking off from traditional schools of thought. Along with the essay Nature, it was really Emerson's coming out or rise to popularity in America. And today, it's really not that well known, but I think it still kind of resounds in the spirit of Ralph Waldo Emerson. So please join us, follow along, and call in if you have any questions.
So just to put things into perspective, since none of us have ever read this essay before, and none of us are experts on Emerson by any means, so just to put things into perspective, we're assuming that you're right there with us. If you're not, even better, and please call in and edify us if you think that we're misinterpreting Emerson. But I want to play a clip, and it's about a 2.5-minute clip, and it's from the book The Metaphysical Club by Louis Menaud. I think that's how you pronounce his last name. It's a great book, and it's about the intellectual history of the early United States. Talks a lot about Oliver Wendell Holmes, who was very good friends with Ralph Waldo Emerson. Oliver Wendell Holmes, a very famous American Supreme Court justice. And so in any case, this is about a 2.5-minute clip from this book. It's the audio version of the book, The Metaphysical Club. After that clip is over, we will begin our conversation. Here comes the clip.
Emerson's standing in the culture of mid-century New England tells us something about the culture of mid-century New England and something about Emerson. Emerson worked out most of his ideas in the form of public lectures. Unsympathetic listeners sometimes thought them dreamy and diffuse. Sympathetic ones frequently found them galvanizing. James Russell Lowell recalled the lecture on The American Scholar as an event without any former parallel in our literary annals. A scene to be always treasured in the memory for its picturesqueness and inspiration. What crowded and breathless aisles, what windows clustering with eager heads, what enthusiasm of approval. An apparently incoherent and unintelligible address was the reaction of the aged Reverend John Pierce to the same speech. He professed to have a method, but I could not trace it. It was a generational difference. But it was not only a generational difference, for there is a division within Emerson's thought itself. Emerson was a genuine moralist, whose mistrust of moralism led him continually to complicate and deflect his own formulations. He was a preacher whose message was, "Don't listen to preachers." I like the silent church before the service begins better than any preaching, as he put it in the essay on self-reliance. We are still going to church, in other words, but we're no longer there to hear someone else tell us what to do. Emerson represented the tradition of the New England churchman, which is one reason he became an honored and respected figure despite his anti-institutionalism. And at the same time, he represented that tradition's final displacement. Unitarianism had rescued the integrity of the individual conscience from Calvinism. Emerson rescued it from Unitarianism. Which is why after his famous address to the Harvard Divinity School in 1838, in which he scandalized the Unitarians by renouncing organized Christianity in favor of personal revelation, he was not invited to speak at Harvard again for 30 years. By the time he returned, religion was no longer an issue most people in Cambridge cared to fight about. The last of the anti-Darwinists were just going under. I regard it as the irresistible effect of the Copernican astronomy to have made the theological scheme of redemption absolutely incredible, Emerson announced in 1832 in a sermon in which he also announced his disbelief in a supernatural Jesus. He had, as usual, gotten there about a generation ahead of schedule.
Right, so that was a clip from the Metaphysical Club about Emerson and a little bit about the speech American Scholar and how it was received well by the younger generations, and the older generations didn't really see any sort of coherent message to it. So with that, we are going to start. This essay that we're reading from is a 14-page PDF. As Mike said, you can access this PDF on our show resources page, ethicstalk.cmish.edu. It's also on the very front page of ethicstalk.cmish.edu. Right after the description of the show, it says click here to see the PDF. And this is, we all have it in front of us. And in talking before the show, we probably won't get past the first six pages. It's somewhat of a dense essay. But to begin, Dr. Russo is on the line with us. And Dr. Russo, could you begin by talking about some things that you find interesting in the beginning of the essay?
Well, first of all, as you said, it's very dense, and there's so much in here, and also it's a wonderful essay. Wow. The thing in the very beginning that struck me as a really powerful idea that, for me, resonates with some other things I've read and so forth and experiences, and seems to, like, come through as a sort of thread through the whole thing, and it's recalled a little bit at the end, is the idea that he brings up in the very beginning here about sort of like the archetype of humanity, or where he says that there is but one man, you know, capital O-M. and he mentions a fable in which it is said that in the beginning kind of thing, man as one entity was divided into men, or humanity became, you know, many human beings so that it could better take care of itself, basically. I think that's a beautiful image. It reminds me in particular of some things that Socrates says in Plato's Republic about the unity of the city-state, and how each citizen in the city-state is like a limb of one body. And he explains that when you get a prick on your finger, it's not your finger's pain, it's like your pain, the whole person, like, shares in the well-being of every part of the body equally, sort of thing. And so it's like your good and your well-being is as much a concern for you, or sorry, another person's well-being is as much a concern for you as your own, sort of like your good and the other's good are one thing. This notion that, like, inherent in each individual person is the whole of humanity is a very powerful idea. When he mentions on the second page here an example, I think it comes through really clearly what he's talking about. I'll just read this one short sentence that he says on page 2 at the near the top. He says, "Man is thus metamorphosed into a thing, into many things. The planter, who is man sent out into the field to gather food, is seldom cheered by any idea of the true dignity of his ministry. He sees his bushel and his cart and nothing beyond, and sinks into the farmer instead of man on the farm. The tradesman scarcely ever gives an ideal worth to his work, but is ridden by the routine of his craft, and the soul is subject to dollars. The priest becomes a form, the attorney a statute book, the mechanic a machine, the sailor a rope of ship." And I think what he's describing here is very beautifully is some sort of, like, you know, fall of man type thing, where the idea is an original sort of more luminous perception, almost of like Platonic forms, in a sense, to see in one action that you are performing sort of like the form of man, so to speak, or humanity as a type of being or something to that effect, living and acting on the earth, that, you know, what we do is just what humanity is. But we lose sight of that fact. Our perception of the particulars and the immediate experience of the day-to-day work and so forth clouds our vision of the more overarching, as you've described it here, man on the farm, you know, humanity bringing forth food from the earth kind of thing. I think that that's a beautiful image to have that experience that maybe we get like very infrequently in moments and little glimpses of a kind of gestalt shift sort of thing where you have like many experiences one by one that you're very close up to. And then in a shift of perception, you kind of like they all come together into an essence of something like what is it that really is going on here? And I think that's a very powerful thing. Let's see. He makes like a connection with this idea, not that explicitly, but a little bit lower on this page where he talks about sort of the young mind sees just many particular things individually and learns how to find like sympathies and similarities between things and forms like a unity out of many things. This is a kind of process that many people have talked about, and Aristotle has some nice passages about this process in his work Posterior Analytics, where you begin to develop this kind of general conception of the form or essence of things. And our experience day to day tends to like occlude or block our view for really these like eternal forms. And I think he captures that really beautifully. And so, as he continues his point about the scholar, which is the title of this essay, The American Scholar, is that this, what is the scholar then? If the farmer is man on the farm, what is the scholar? And his answer is man thinking. And at one point later in the essay, he says something like, the true scholar, is the eye of the world and the heart of the world. And it's in a way like just humanity itself or humanity as a whole exercising its mind. And I think that's very powerful. One way I think to just in a nutshell maybe get the gist of this idea about like the one human being as opposed to the humanity that we might perceive, I think is illustrated nicely by when Neil Armstrong, you know, stepped off of the lunar module onto the moon, and he said, "It's one small step for man and a giant leap for mankind." And so it's like that one person just did one small minor thing, but it represented and at the same time was like humanity has made it to the moon kind of thing. And to sense that and to perceive that one small event with that greater magnitude is the perception of a greater reality, I think you would agree. And so I think what he's talking about in the beginning here is to have that kind of deeper perception of, you know, our humanity as it is, like, inherent in everyone, in all of the things that we do. Let's see. There you go.
I don't know. I was just going to jump in there with the man thinking. I think he kind of presents, you know, when he first describes in the right state, he is a man thinking. In the degenerate state, when the victim of society, he tends to become a mere thinker, or still worse, the parrot of other men's thinking. And when you were describing how the young mind looks at all these things as individual separate parts and eventually comes together to kind of see the unification of it all, I was thinking that the men thinking is really the unification of man as this thinking entity, you know, that we're all connected by it, rather than an individualized thinker. And I'm going to kind of break the rules here and jump way ahead to something that I think is really useful to drawing out this distinction between the unification of man thinking versus the thinker as individualized, where he says,
¿Qué página?
On page 9 at the bottom, he says, The orator distrusts at first the fitness of his frank confessions, his want of knowledge of the persons he addresses, until he finds that he is the complement of his hearers, that they drink his words because he fulfills for them their own nature. The deeper he, here's the key part, the deeper he dives into his privatest, secretest presentiment, to wonder he finds this is the most acceptable, most public, and universally true. The people delight in it. The better part of every man feels it. This is my music. This is myself. And so this idea that, you know, we have all these deep, dark things that kind of are latent within our subconsciousness and perhaps even our conscious minds, that, you know, once you really go into, it takes, and he at this part is somewhat talking about the bravery that it takes to be the man thinking, to really come out and say these things that are deep and latent, and kind of dark, I guess, in a way. But as these come out, it turns out this is what people are really interested in hearing, at least the better parts of them are interested in feeling, that being the man thinking. So that's
I feel compelled to play the clip from Walk the Line.
That clip's awesome. We should play it. My vote, yeah.
What I find incredibly entertaining is that the, you know, Emerson idea of a dark thought is like, fight the system, man. You know, like, don't be just a thinker. Be a creator.
Yes, creation is absolutely important to what it is to be a, quote, man thinking. And I don't know, at this point, I don't know if I'm going to get us off track, but Dr. Ruth, did you want to respond to what Nick is saying?
I mean, yeah, I think you're right. That passage is that you pointed to is right on point. You know, I don't know, again, I don't know what the track even is, but this could go off track, but I'll just throw it out there in case anyone finds it interesting to think about later. I think there's implications to that idea there, the basic thing at the very beginning, and that particular line on page 9 that goes on to 10 that you just read. Implications about, like, what to say about, you know, the recluses and the people who, like, go off from society and, you know, sit in a cave and meditate and stuff, and in some circles are considered to be, like, lame and not contributing anything to humanity. And I think that there's a point at which it's sort of like, I don't know what to call it, juxtaposes nicely with this idea that there's like one humanity that we all have, and each human being is that same being. And as he says at one point, in most people, it's like as yet unborn, but it's like there. And a juxtaposing idea that I think is nice, and it's a good point, is later he says, where is it? Something like, there's no one person or one kind of pursuit, like, in life that is, like, the definitive expression of that, you know, one man kind of thing, or humanity. And so he says something very poetic and beautiful. I'm trying to find it here. Like, no one can close off this boundless identity with, like, this is it. I represent, like, how the ideal human being is supposed to be, sort of thing.
Is that on page 11, we crave a better and more abundant food. The man who has never lived that can feed us ever. That part?
Yes.
The human mind
there.
Cannot be enshrined in a person.
That,
we shall set a
yes.
barrier, blah, blah, blah.
That part.
Okay.
So it's like in line with his idea at the very beginning, there's like a sort of division of labor, so to speak, of all the different kinds of individual human beings who do different things, who some people are like poets and other people are mathematicians and other people are like trash collectors and whatever. There's all this different stuff that human beings do. In spite of the fact, or even like in harmony with the fact, that we're all one being, and so we divide in order to take care of ourself. So that the idea that people who like, there's a word that's not coming to my mind, you know, abandon society or whatever you want to say, somehow don't represent, you know, any people who do any contribution to humanity. And I think what he's saying here is, up in that quote on page 9, contradicts that idea that, you know, amidst all the things that human beings do, it's like we need somebody to just sit in a cave maybe for, you know, 30 years and, like, meditate, and what happens? I mean, they might learn something about human consciousness that, like, we need to know. Somebody should, that's good. And there are other things he says, and I won't waste time trying to, like, sift through the pages to find, but that made me think about a lot of things that don't come off immediately as having, like, a practical application. You know, end up, you never know, like people thinking about infinity, you know, and like, you know, things that are mathematically make sense, but have no actuality, like infinitesimal things or what have you, eventually leads to like calculus and then has all kinds of unforeseen effects.
Like so amusement parks?
Yes, like everything technology ever produced, almost. So it's like, you know, the one human being that is, in a sense, all of us, has to be expressed in a whole wide variety of, like, different things. And if it's done authentically and with, like, integrity or what have you, and with respect for that common identity, that's what matters. It's not that there's some one role that is, like, the pinnacle of human development, like, whatever. So I think that's an important point, and that's what I would say.
Yeah. I just wanted to say, go ahead.
Yeah, just like talking about the division of labor, it sounds like at one point Emerson is really like saying this is a quality thing that society's done, dividing into different trades. But he also sort of seems to continue and say that like labor has been so distributed to multitudes, quote, that it has been minutely subdivided and peddled out and spills into drops and can never be gathered. It kind of like, sounds like he's saying like we've gone a little too far with this division of labor, and like people are becoming sort of alienated in their specializations.
Right.
Yeah, and to build on what I think to kind of tie it in is the way that seems to be pervasive through the whole essay, I guess, is this sense of living. How to word this? In a way where it's like, the times when you're just sitting around and like, I don't know, let's say you're washing dishes or let's say you're a dishwasher and that's the labor that you have to do, there's actually time there to really experience and like have some meaningful thought that occurs at that period too. So it seems like any experience and kind of Emerson's thinking is always an opportunity for the mind to really call on something that it has, you know, not called on before and really feel, I guess, that unification of man thinking and, you know, have some sort of universal truth. And I think this goes, you know, this goes into when he talks about books and that, you know, books kind of fill this time when don't have a lot of stuff going on in our brain and we almost need something to kind of give us that push towards something different, although the books themselves are not good without, you know, are useless, I guess, without the reader, you know, washing dishes at some point and coming to some point where he's like, whoa, I get it, you know, like, or
this is applicable.
Right.
Yeah, just on labor, on page 8, he's definitely, you know, gaga about the right approach to labor. And I think, you know, this is the Puritan influence coming through in his thought. Because the Puritans, what they did was basically bring God down to earth through labor and action. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, I think Dr. Russo, I think something you said something last week, like, didn't you quote Jesus?
Probably, I don't know. Yes,
and you
I
said,
remember.
Like, the kingdom of God is all around you or something like that. Not
right.
Ringing any bells.
Kingdom
anyway,
of
my
heaven
point being, you know, same idea with the Puritans that, you know, it's through work and action that we experience something divine. And this is on page 8, and it's like the second full paragraph, beginning with I hear, therefore, with joy, whatever is beginning to be said of the dignity and necessity of labor to every citizen. There is virtue yet in the hoe and the spade. for learned as well as unlearned hands, and labor is everywhere welcome. Always we are invited to work. And so, as Nick is saying, there's this, it's like almost like a breathing. I, through reading this essay, I felt like there's this metaphor of something like exhaling and inhaling, and the soul is like its rhythm is reading and doing, reading and doing, and the one feeds the other. But the doing is the material. He says the doing is the material for the thinking. The reading is what we do when we can't do, because you get weary and so forth. So all of these things, and this is a new view of the scholar, because when we think of the scholar, we think of somebody, as Dr. Russo was saying, like in a cave doing nothing. And I wanted to just, not doing nothing, but contemplating without a hoe and a spade. But I wanted to say is one thing that may be provocative towards that claim about the scholar that Dr. Russo was talking about is that when Emerson is talking about books, this is on page 4, and it is the third full paragraph, books are the best of things. He says, books are the best of things, well used, abused among the worst. What is the right use? What is the one end which all means go to effect? They are for nothing but to inspire. And so going back to the work that we all do, if it does result in a book, like the book is to inspire and to progress humanity or something like this. So that's something that stuck out to me. But I just wanted to mention that little gloss about labor, since we're talking about labor. And I think that there's a connection between that and the Puritans' reverence of labor as a way of participating in God.
Do you think that's labor for labor's own sake, or do you think it's labor for something else?
Well, I don't want to answer that question. I think that will take us, away from the essay, so I'm just going to decline respectfully to answer that one.
To me, it kind of seems like it's sort of this, like, a denial that some person should be out there only hoeing. It's like you should hoe for yourself so that you're not relying on some one person to have this over-specialized, really, like, monotonous work space, so that they, too, can be man-thinking. They're not just sort of hoeing all day long and not having access to books or something.
Right.
If I could jump in, I mean, related to that comment and something said earlier, I forget who read part of the quote on page 1 about the division of labor is like has been overemphasized so that people are too fragmented and it has made us lose our sense of whatever the common humanity kind of thing. At the bottom of page 1, where that quote continues, though, it says, the fable that man is one thing that was divided into many so that it could take care of itself. The fable implies that the individual, to possess himself, must sometimes return from his own labor to embrace all the other labors. But unfortunately, this original unit, this fountain of power, has been so distributed to multitudes, has been so split up and blah, 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 that, like, we've lost essence or what have you. So I think that, I mean, it's like a balancing act. The division of labor is something good. As he says, it's like the hand was split into 5 fingers that made it able to, like, grasp onto stuff. There's a nice quote that also is the same basic theme by Marcus Aurelius, who says, we are made for cooperation. We are like the upper and the lower rows of the teeth. You know, without the lower row, just the upper row can't chew on anything. And so we, like, go together and balance each other and, like, make the whole whatever society possible.
And somehow we have to refrain from being, like, at the end of that, the same quote you were reading, there's the talking about how some members have suffered amputation from the trunk and walking about
right.
Like monsters, that thing. So somehow we need to return and appreciate all the other parts of this community.
I mean, one way of doing that, I think, I don't know if he would accept this or whatever, but I mean, does what does that mean, like return to the root and embrace the labor of all the others? Maybe that means literally, like, you know, you should do many different things to just have an appreciation of what, you know, I don't know, these other ways of living are like or something like that.
Right.
Or maybe just, you know, like the stereotype of the scholar person who's like cut off from the rest of humanity and like doesn't know anything about how quote unquote ordinary people live sort of thing.
Right.
And that's bad. And if you like at the least, you know, associate with other people and understand them, that kind of thing. Maybe you don't necessarily like quit your job as a professor and go work on a farm. I don't know. Maybe you do though, but at the least that you have some kind of intermingling with many different people, kinds of people. I think just as one last note that I think the ideal of the city-state that Socrates mentions in the Republic is that it should not be so big that people don't actually know everyone else, that it should be big enough so that there's enough people to take care of all the necessities of life, but small enough so that there are few enough people so that everybody can, like, know each other in some way. And maybe at least that is, like, this returning back to the labors of all the others is, like, by appreciating and understanding what's involved in the life of the guy who's the farmer and so forth helps you to, like, reconnect to your own humanity that you have in common with that person.
I had a slightly different gloss on this one sentence. The fable implies that the individual to possess himself must sometimes return from his own labor to embrace all the other laborers. Again, this is at the bottom of page one if you're listening. And as I read this and then going on to page two, you know, man is thus metamorphized into a thing, into many things. The planter who is man set out into the field to gather food, blah, blah, blah. He's not man on the farm. He just sees his bushel and his cart and nothing beyond and sinks into the farmer instead of man on the farm. The priest becomes a form, the attorney a statue book, the mechanic a machine, the sail the rope of a ship. What this triggered in my head was a very famous essay by Sir Henry Maine called From Status to Contract. The whole idea that, you know, our identities are wrapped up into a status. Like, we have these labels like farmer, attorney, priest, and so forth. And with these labels and statuses, or stati, come, you know, different routines and habits and so forth. And we get caught up in that, and we lose the fact that there's, you know, a human being behind it. And so when I read, the fable implies that the individual must sometimes return from his own labor to embrace all the other laborers, I read that as like qua humans, not as qua laborers. So
sure.
It's like, you know, this is known, you know, in a more colloquial manner as the silo effect. You could see this in our own college, right? That people in the English department don't talk to people in the philosophy department, and people in the philosophy department don't talk to people in the neuroscience department. Everybody's in their own little world. And we're wrapped up in these routines, and it's necessary to stand back from those and see all of these other people as people to come to that unified view of humanity. That's how I'm looking at it. So I'm sort of abstracting from the embrace all laborers to embrace all other laborers as qua human beings. But anyway, that was just my two cents.
Yeah, that same idea kind of comes up in the bottom of page two when Emerson's talking about classification by the young mind, and everything seems to be an individual, and as you grow older, you see the ties between things.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to be like a big undercurrent of what he's looking for in the American scholar.
Yeah, definitely, like, one thing that I walk away with after reading this is that we're all the same mind. maybe I should play Walk the Line to give us a concrete example of that. Do you guys want me to play that?
Do it.
Do it.
All right. I'm going to play Walk the Line for, like, I don't know, we play this like every other show. It's such a great clip. But it's a concrete example of how, you know, someone who, quote, speaks the truth, like, people recognize it when they hear it. We've also talked about this, I think when we talked about William James, this whole idea of, like, the Pied Piper, you know, like when somebody is actually working on him or herself to become man-thinking, that is recognized by other people, and they gravitate towards that. And so this is expressed in the film Walk the Line about Johnny Cash. And so here comes the clip, and I think it's about 3-4 minutes long.
Yes, I know when Jesus saved me,
saved my soul.
The very moment he forgave me,
made me whole.
He took away my heavy burdens. Lord, he gave me peace within.
Peace within.
Well, Satan can't make me doubt it.
I won't doubt it.
It's real and I'm gonna shout it.
I'm gonna shout it.
Well, I was there with...
Hold on. I hate to interrupt, but you guys got something else. I'm sorry. I can't market gospel no more.
So that's it?
I don't record material that doesn't sell, Mr. Cash, and gospel like that doesn't sell.
So is it the gospel or the way I sing it?
Both.
Well, what's wrong with the way I sing it?
I don't believe you.
You saying I don't believe in God?
J.R., come on, let's go.
No. I won't understand. I mean, we come down here, we play for a minute, and he tells me I don't believe in God.
You know exactly what I'm telling you. We've already heard that song 100 times, just like that, just like how you sang it.
Well, he didn't let us bring it home.
Bring it home? All right, let's bring it home. He was hit by a truck. And you were lying out in that gutter dying, and you had time to sing one song. Huh? One song people would remember before your dirt. One song that would let God know what you felt about your time here on earth. One song that would sum you up. You telling me that's the song you'd sing? That same Jimmy Davis tune we hear on the radio all day about your peace within and how it's real and how you're going to shout it. Or would you sing something different? Something real. Something you felt. Because I'm telling you right now, that's the kind of song people want to hear. That's the kind of song that truly saves people. It ain't got nothing to do with believing in God, Mr. Cash. It has to do with believing in yourself.
Yeah. I think that's so Emersonian. Towards the end of the essay, he talks a lot about self-trust, which I don't think we're going to touch in this show. But in any case, I'll just leave it at that. Anybody want
to? I have a thought to pick up on. I'm jumping around a little bit. But Dr. Rousseau had been talking a little bit about the scholar, or more specifically, the sort of false scholar.
The bookworm?
I was just going to say, I think Emerson refers to him as, instead of man thinking, we have the bookworm. And the idea here is someone who's lost in the books, someone who spends all their time in the library and never gets any farther with their knowledge than that. Now, just let me put the proviso here. It's not as though Emerson's bashing, you know, the bookworm, which I sort of thought he was, but I had to read it carefully a few times. And he does specifically say in one section, look, you know, books are great for all these reasons, and the scholar is, you know, useful and necessary for all these reasons. But he talks about the right way of reading and the wrong way of reading. I'm not going to skip over all that. I'm sure we'll come back to it. Very good material. But I just wanted to touch on this idea of the false scholar. I'm on page 6 now, section 3. He starts by saying, there goes into the world a notion that the scholar should be a recluse. I'm not sure how to pronounce this next word, but I think it is valetudinarian. I don't know if anyone can explain to me exactly what that means.
Sounds like the right pronunciation, at least.
I think it's a recluse.
Okay.
I looked it up. A valetudinarian is a person who is overly concerned with themselves being sick all the time.
What?
That's what it said. I looked it up.
Wow.
Okay. I thought it was someone who like receives the highest honors when they graduate from high school. Or I know.
Come on. No, anyway, as unfit for any handiwork or public labor as a penknife for an axe, the so-called practical men sneer at speculative men,
as if because they speculate or see, they could do nothing. This idea is because they spend so much time in the books, they can't do what I do. You know, they can't labor, they can't work on engines, they can't hoe a field. And he goes on to talk about this sort of false scholar. Action is with the scholar subordinate, but it is essential. Without it, he is not yet man. Without it, thought can never ripen into truth. I'm skipping to the very end here. Only so much do I know as I have lived. Instantly, we know whose words are loaded with life and whose are not. If I had to pick one sentence from the whole paper, I think that would be it.
Hmm.
We know instantly whose words are loaded with life and whose are not. Now, he's sort of taking a careful criticism of the scholar here. It's not as though he's saying, you know, look, you scholars are useless. He's simply saying, look, knowledge alone doesn't cut it.
Hmm.
Without application of the knowledge, without creativity, he goes on to talk about all of these things, without sort of taking it and making it your own and, you know, putting out some new, I think the word distill he uses quite
mm-hmm.
often, without distilling this knowledge into something that can be used by others, you're just practicing theory, I think
yeah.
is how I'd say it.
I feel like you wouldn't even call it knowledge if you haven't actually gone out and utilized it and seen if it works. It
right.
translates to the world actual.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love this passage too, and at the bottom of page 6, as I said before, there's this you know, metaphor that I kept getting from the whole essay, which is like this idea of breathing and inhaling and exhaling. And at the very bottom of page 6, he's talking about action. I'm looking at the very end of the big chunk paragraph beginning with the world. I do not see how any man can afford, for the sake of his nerves and his nap, to spare any action in which he can partake. It is pearls and rubies to his discourse. Drudgery, calamity, exasperation, want are instructors in eloquence and wisdom. The true scholar grudges every opportunity of action passed by as a loss of power. And then here's really this passage that follows that is where I just get this idea of it's almost like we're a function or like an operation where we perform an action and then that action is actually coming from some sort of instinct and then that action is able to be converted into something that we can think about. Action, he says it, he's referring to action, is the raw material out of which the intellect molds her splendid products. A strange process to this, by which experience is converted into thought, as a mulberry leaf is converted into satin. The manufacture goes forward at all hours. And I just thought this is a very rhythmic process to the thinking man, the man thinking of action, reflection, and as Mike is saying, you know, just this bookworm, I think it follows nicely after the Walk the Line clip because Johnny Cash has mastered all these cover tunes.
Mm-hmm.
And there's nothing true coming out of them. And he's like the bookworm, the musical bookworm. And the producer's like, you know, yo, that's not it. You have to distill something that's true.
Right.
And then he sings Folsom Prison. So.
Nice. And, you know,
I think...
I'll just
well,
throw
since
one
we're on a,
go,
if I can
that's
throw in the quote,
seven.
I can't tell. Since we're on a fest of quoting great lines, and it goes right along with that very point, so let me just throw this in about you know the experience giving you like material that is distilled into truth in thought and so forth. Right above the thing that you just read, Hope, is this line that is really great, where he says, I grasp the hands of those next to me and take my place in the ring to suffer and to work, taught by an instinct that so shall the dumb abyss be vocal with speech. I like that a lot. that the experiences that we have are like a material that inherently is not yet intelligible, so to speak. It's like it's material for that in a way like has content or has something there that's like a revelation waiting to be had in some sense, but it takes like the work of thought to grasp it and see it and so forth. And this line, the dumb abyss being vocal with speech, is Wow. It's kind anyway, of put, sorry for breaking it.
No, that's great. It's pretty much put just a different way at the bottom of page 7 that Hope brought us to, is talking about like the actual work and like what it does for the intellect.
Mm.
It's just, I thought it was a beautiful quote when I was reading through it. It's, colleges and books only copy the language which the field and the workyard made. So it's like this sort of, yeah, everything that you're reading about was come to you by action, and you shouldn't just settle on someone else's thought on action. You should also look towards your own action.
Mm.
We're almost organizing this essay for you, but right on the same idea.
Emerson would not approve.
We have to be discordant
quoting,
all over the place, right?
Just don't listen to us.
Right. Then the people who don't really understand will just think us intelligible. It's like our own secret language. On this same idea of Johnny Cash, you know, just mastering old gospel tunes rather than, you know, playing Folsom Prison or some new tune, picking up right where Chris left off, although this is on page 4, which I skipped over, so come back to it. We quoted this paragraph already. It's the paragraph, "Books are the best things."
Mm.
I'm going to start off about halfway through it. "The book, the college, the school of art, the institution of any kind, stop with some past utterance of genius. This is good, they say. Let us hold by this. They pin me down. They look backward and not forward. But genius looks forward. The eyes of man are set in his forehead, not in his hind head. Man hopes. Genius creates. Whatever talents may be, if the man create not, the pure efflux of the deity is not his. Cinders and smoke there may be, but not yet flame." A really cool metaphor that Emerson uses. I doubt that he was the first, and he was certainly not the last, but this idea of flame. Chris may know the passage. There's the part when he talks about man thinking as a sort of lighting on fire, that learning, you digging out the quote for me, Chris? Beautiful. All right, well, you find that. I'll keep talking. There's this idea that being the scholar first or learning first sort of like puts tinder down. It's that we're taking these books and ripping up pages and setting down a fire to be burned. And when it lights, that's when we become man-thinking, that
right.
When we sort of ignite it and set our hearts on fire.
So actually, it looks like Nick and I both found something that pertains to what we thought Mike was talking about.
Go for it.
So this is going on the value of books, sort of like Mike was saying, that there is some of Emerson that's saying we do need to do some reading. And this is on the top of page 6. "Of course, there is a portion of reading quite indispensable to a wise man. History and exact science he must learn by laborious reading. Colleges, in like manner, have their indispensable office to teach elements. But they can only serve us when they aim not to drill but to create, when they gather from far every ray of various genius to their hospitable halls, and by the concentrated fires set the hearts of their youth on flame." And I'd like to hope that CMU is concentrating worldly fires to set...
I think St. John's is. I don't know about
yeah,
CMU.
I was going to say CMU's lacking in that department.
Well, we're no New York City.
Well, no, it's not St. John's University, St. John's in New Mexico. It's a college.
Well, there's one in Annapolis and there's one in New Mexico. There's two campuses.
Right, yeah, my bad.
But anyway, hey, you know, we can be St. John's in miniature.
Yeah.
But, no, I really like this idea, and it goes back to the Pied Piper, you
mm-hmm.
know, like moth to the flame. So man thinking, like, he's on fire, and then, like Johnny Cash, when he plays Folsom Prison, he's on fire, and everybody, you know, gravitates towards that because they see something real and authentic,
mm-hmm.
and, quote, that's what sells. That's what we're all craving for, is somebody to be like that, but it's us who must be like that to be truly who we are.
No, I mean, I guess this will take us away from the actual text by asking this question. So, again, just respectfully decline if this is too moving away from where we're supposed to be. But I don't know. I feel that in a large part, and I can actually find a quote that I think somewhat Emerson goes with on this. But basically, like, you have this idea of pop culture and like a lot of things that I don't think have a lot of value that do sell a lot, you know, and there's millions of dollars of advertising and things that go into these things.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it seems like we're saying, like, human naturally understands the, like, the good stuff and, like, appreciates it. And I really feel that, like, it takes, like, you know, he says the, and I've quoted this already, I believe it's on page 2, never mind, I don't have it around me right now, but basically the best parts of men will notice the good stuff, and not their bad parts, you know, may notice something different. And so I guess wanted to ask the question, like, what is it that allows man to I guess, understand the good stuff or, like, gravitate towards the good stuff? Is that at all mentioned in the essay? Or is the vice part of that or the bad part of humanity mentioned in this essay that takes away from that? I'm sorry, that was really choppy.
It's a really good question.
It is.
I don't want to touch that one.
Well, I can say... I don't get so much this idea of, or at least let me say this, I don't know that it's the central point of Emerson to say, look, you know, this is natural, this happens naturally. I think he's more calling us to do this more than he's saying, look, you know, this is the nature of man.
Yes.
And in a section, I know Chris might be able to follow this up too, but in a section that Dr. Rousseau already quoted, I'm going to go ahead and read it again. I grasp the hands of those next to me and take my place in the ring to suffer and to work, taught by an instinct that so shall the dumb abyss be vocal with speech. I think he's saying, look, you know, I'm one of those that's going to jump down, get in the nitty-gritty, and, you know, bust my butt.
Hence, we're reading this 100-something years later.
Right. Well, in that particular section, I think there's definitely some abstract, you know, deep thought I'm missing. But on its surface, he's definitely saying, look, you know, this is hard. It's not easy.
Yeah.
There's going to be some work here.
And, I mean, to build on that, so he's talking about this authenticity, that I guess, that people tend to gravitate towards, or this man thinking that people will gravitate towards. And in the same, and I think you mentioned it well, and I don't have the words right now to rearticulate the main point, but basically it's ourselves that need to do this rather than the idea of some sort of fame or, you know, the popularity of it, which dictates its goodness or not. But here's I feel like we're just shooting out so many quotes, but I guess that's what happens when you read Emerson and you have five people talking about it. In any case, this is kind of about the kind of rough path it is for the authentic man thinking, or for the man thinking thing. This is on page 9, and it is the first paragraph, about 4 lines down. Long he must stammer in his speech, and I imagine he's talking, I think this is him referring to the man thinking, often forego the living for the dead. Worse yet, he must accept how often poverty and solitude, for the ease and pleasure of treading the old world, accepting the fashions, the education, the religion of society, he takes the cross of making his own, and, of course, the self-accusation, the faint heart, the frequent uncertainty and loss of time, which are the nettles and tangling vines in the way of the self-relying and self-directed, and the state of virtual hostility in which he seems to stand to society, and especially to educated society. So there I think you have this idea of where there's a large rejection in terms of the society and the way in which the popular denies the man thinking, and that you have to kind of go at it alone and be willing to accept the consequences. I mean, just the line, often forego the living for the dead.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah.
Yeah, and right before that, he says, in the long period of his preparation. Again, like, this is something hard. He must betray often an ignorance and a shiftlessness in popular arts, incurring the disdain of the able who shoulder him aside. So this is like, you know, again, as Mike said, this is not something easy.
I'm just picturing him, you know, tearing out book pages as he reads them. Like, here, this is on my fire now. I don't know.
There's actually a scene in the film The Razor's Edge. You guys ever seen that?
Mm-mm.
Great movie, book by Somerset Maugham. But Dr. Rousseau, do you know the scene that I'm thinking of?
No.
Have you seen the film?
I did, like, many years ago, and I don't remember it.
Okay, well, anyway, the protagonist is on his path to enlightenment, and it's hard. He goes to India, and he works with some sort of monk, and the monk says, you're going to go climb that mountain, and here's your little backpack, and it's like freezing, and he has all these books with him, and he realizes to stay warm, he needs to read the book and then burn each page.
We need that clip. That sounds amazing.
Yeah, it is. Well, there's no audio to it, so maybe I'll put it on YouTube.
Yeah.
Without, I guess, doing so much more quotations, I'm going to try to paraphrase something, and I don't have the particular page, but my guess is it's somewhere on 4, where we read these, you know, these great books, you know, of Cicero, Locke, and Bacon are the three examples that he uses. And we look at them as these big authorities, and you know, I find oftentimes in classes where you're reading these great, you know, these great people, or you know, even contemporary philosophers, semioticians I've been dealing a lot with, and you find yourself in disagreement with them, you know. But it's like, you know, Locke and Bacon are so, you know, BA, you know, they're so great. It's like, how can you disagree with them? But I think that's part of the point, is being able to be like, well, I don't really care, you know, what some guy said 2,500 years ago or 2,000 years ago. It's like, this is what I'm thinking about it now. And, you know, I guess it goes with this idea that, you know, man hopes, the genius creates. So I think we have this sense of acquiescing to the authority of the kind of structure that's built around these books as these, you know, such... Right. Correct and awesome,
yeah.
Things that there's no room to disagree, and I think that's just what they're made for, is to disagree with and to build against or for, depending on what your inward forces are demanding.
So feel free to upset the dogmatic beliefs that we're being taught.
Right.
Yeah, I think that it's significant that he says that the true scholar or what have you, who's like involved in this solitary struggle, is what is the word? Virtual hostility in which he stands to society, and then he adds, and especially to educated society.
Oh,
I think
right.
That touches actually on an aspect of what we talked about on the last show about like science and religion and philosophy and so forth, and like questioning instead of just believing what authority figures of one kind or another have to say. And I think his point there touches on the fact, or I don't know, that it's exactly what he meant, but I think for us now it relates to the fact that even within, you know, academic circles where free thinking and so forth and like questioning is this ideal, you know, you don't always get a very positive reaction when you do that, actually, if it contradicts the high, you know, great... examples of philosophers, so that it's like verbally the thing is to question everything, but if you try to do that, it's like no, you know, these great minds already thought that out and came to an answer, and so if you think for yourself, you'll arrive at that answer too, so just shut up with your different story that you're trying to present here, kind of thing. So that same idea of like a dogmatic authority, like, you know, creeps in through the back door, kind of thing. And it's like it's in place in the very spot where it's supposed to be, this free-thinking thing. And so, as he says there, it's like the educated people who have lots of knowledge about a whole lot of things are not always open-minded to different ways of thinking. And because they're so smart, they have a lot of ability to resist changing their mind. I like to think of it by analogy. It's kind of like if you think of sort of Socrates or the true philosopher in some sense as kind of like bringing his method of examination as like a medicine kind of thing. There are analogies that Plato uses to this effect. To sort of cure the disease of like being unclear but just holding to it anyway. The thing that happens, though, in some cases is as if the doctor who went to cure the disease just caught the disease and now he just spreads it everywhere. So that the thinking, you know, and the analytical ability just comes to be used to reinforce whatever people think. They're just going to have a more and more powerful way to, like, never see it a different way. I've encountered this many times in personal experience, actually. So I think that's an important little point at the end of his sentence there.
And the end of the show, I would say. Because we have 19 seconds and counting. So I think we may continue this next week.
Yep.
And
want to read more. Read self-reliance.
All right. So we'll be back next week with more Emerson. So you've been listening to Ethics Talk. Make sure you check out the essay. It's on our webpage, ethicstalk.cmich.edu. Good night.